Good morning. I just had one of the scary moments. I looked down and the switch was on this microphone that was in my pocket. And I apologize if y'all heard my singing more than normal. That was not meant to be, if you will. Randolph Gauntz was going to be with us this week. He ended up being sick, and so taking his place. But keep him in your prayers, if you would. And I'd ask that you think about this slide. It's the only slide I've got for today's lesson. But the theme and the focus of this lesson is wholly contained on that slide. And I hope that'll come apparent to you as we walk through some thoughts. Share with you a story to start with about a friend of mine, lived in Tullahoma, who enjoyed caving. And he explored caves under Huntsville, and he would talk about that when I'd eat lunch with him some days. And he had some amazing stories, but he came back one day and was talking about being in a cave under Huntsville, where, and you can imagine how it is when you go caving, you sometimes start out walking, and then you end up crawling, and then sometimes slithering to get back in there. And he found this cavern under Huntsville, this huge cavern that just amazed him. And he could walk across it and get its breadth, or walk and get its length, but he couldn't tell how tall it was. And he was puzzled. He wanted to find out. Came home, thought about it like a good engineer. He came up with a plan, and so he went and got a metal bottle, not like a huge K bottle, but a smaller gas cylinder, filled it with helium, got a balloon, got a string, and had his plan. He was going to go back, and he found his way back to the K, found his way back that tortuous path to where that big cavern was, and he got out that bottle. After lugging it back in there, got his balloon and put it to the valve on the bottle. It could fill up that balloon and then let it rise to the top and then measure the length of the string. That's what his plan was, to find out how tall it was. He opened that valve and all he heard was a and that was it. Somehow all the gas was gone from the bottle, and he might have wondered if one of his friends was trying to help him out by keeping him from carrying all that heavy helium down there. I wouldn't know anything about that. But the story that he came back to tell, was not the story he expected to tell. It was not the story of how tall this thing was that he couldn't perceive any other way. It was a story about what was missing. It was a story about what was not there. It was a story about what was empty, what was gone that he expected to have. And sometimes it's things that aren't there that provide most significant evidence for us, or a focus, or a key point in a story. When there's been a report of a robbery and the police go to investigate and there's no sign of forced entry, that's evidence. That tells them something. When a group of planes come back from a military mission and they're flying in a formation where there's a gap, a missing man, there's a story there. There's a message that's there. And the Bible has a number of stories in it in which a key part of the message has to do with what's not present as opposed to what is present. And I want to just briefly share a couple of those thoughts with you. And I'd ask that you go with me, if you will, on an imaginary kind of journey to start with. Imagine you're with me in the Middle East. Imagine you're with me in a desert, arid, harsh kind of land, and there's just not much vegetation. It's not much water, and we're going through that area, and you come over a ridge or a rise, and you look out, and before you, and there's this valley, and in that valley, what looks like an oasis, it's lush, and it's green, and it's verdant, and it looks completely different than this place you've been up to that point. And as you get closer to it, you see there's a wall around this area. It's not a regular oasis. And you see there's a gate, and there's someone standing guard at the gate, a warrior, an angel, with a flaming sword. And as you approach, you ask, what is this place? And if the angel were to answer, he might say, it's a place God made, a garden designed for man to dwell in. And you could ask, well, who lives here? And if you could ask that, the angel might say, well, there's no one here. It's empty. It's empty. God made a perfect place for man to dwell in the Garden of Eden. And we read about it in Genesis. It was an ideal spot where he didn't have to toil the ground. He didn't have to worry about where his food came from. But man chose to listen to the voice of temptation rather than to listen to the voice of the one who had proven always trustworthy. Satan whispered to him, you deserve more. There's more to be had than you've got here. And if you'll just do this thing that God's told you not to do, you'll be complete. You'll have it all. So man made a choice to abandon God, to follow after that voice of temptation. And in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 23, we read about the results of it, how man was banished from the garden, from that ideal dwelling spot, and there was an angel placed there to keep man from entering again, to let man learn the lesson of the consequences of our choice of giving in to temptation. And in that empty garden was a lesson for us about our sinful nature and our choices that we make. Turn over a little bit in the Bible, and if you want to look ahead, look over in 2 Kings chapter 4 and verses 1 through 7. 2 Kings chapter 4 verses 1 through 7. And in that passage, let's just go on an imaginary journey to that place. We'll walk into a rural village, a town where the prophets have worked, where Elisha has worked. And as you go into town, you see a woman, poor widow woman. She's got two sons. And there's a creditor there shaking his finger and threatening her to take all she has and to make her a slave and to make her two sons a slave. And she's got no one to help. Her husband has died. And she goes to Elisha. And Elisha gives some instructions. And you're watching what's going on. And you see this woman and her sons start gathering clay pots. And she's taking them in her house. And she goes to neighbors and asks them for pots. And you wonder, well, what's in these pots? What is it that she is getting? What kind of treasure is it she's gathering up? And your curiosity gets the best of you, and you happen to look in one as she goes by, and you see they're empty. There's nothing in those pots. But she somehow got this objective of getting as many as she can. She puts them all in her house, and the door closes. And standing by the window, you hear a little bit of what's going on, how there was one pot that she had in her house, one jar she had to start with that had oil in it. Apparently the instructions Elisha had given her was to get as many pots as you could. Go in the house, close your doors, then you and your sons pour from that one pot into all the others, that one clay jar. The Bible tells us in that passage in 2 Kings 4, around verse 5 or 6, towards the end of it, where she has filled up the last pot. She tells her son to give her the next one. And he says, no, that's all. That's all there is. And then the oil quit flowing. And she tells Elisha about what's happened. He said, go and sell. Go and sell this. It'll pay off your debts, and you can live on it from now on. And in that story about empty pots, empty clay jars, is a message and a testimony about God's provision, about God's care. This woman lived in a town where there were good folks. She didn't have anywhere to turn but to God, to God's servant Elisha. And God looked down upon her and provided through His providence and through His mercy and took care of her and made what was empty full and gave her abundance beyond measure. Over in 2 Corinthians 4, And verse 7 is a verse that Paul wrote about clay jars, a verse about them being filled in a different way. Paul said, but we have this treasure in jars of clay so that the all-surpassing power of God can be seen to be of God and not of us, not from us. The treasure that Paul was speaking of was the treasure of the gospel, the good news, this message of hope and of forgiveness and of joy, of what God has done for us. And Paul was saying, we're jars of clay. We're imperfect. We're vulnerable. We're broken. We won't last. We're all those things. And God has filled us up like that woman's jars were filled up with something of value that she could never get on her own. God fills us up with his hope, his life, his word, his message to share with others. Turn over a little bit into the Gospels, and there's another story of something missing. And we sung some about it this morning. It's found over in Luke chapter 24, I think. Let's look at it. Luke 24 and verses 13 through 17. And I'll just read this one to you. Familiar passage about an empty place. Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus. The same day, it was the third day after Jesus had been crucified. And two followers of his were on that journey. That same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. And as they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked among them. But they were kept from recognizing him. He's like a stranger. They don't know who he is. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along? What are y'all talking about?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem and don't know the things that have happened there in these days?" "What things?" he asked. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet. He was powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him." And then these words, "But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel." You just hear that despondency in those words. "But we had hoped that he was the one that was going to redeem Israel. And what's more, it's the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but they did not find his body." An empty place. An empty place. And what a testimony there was in that empty place. Over in Matthew 28 and verse 5, you read of the account of the women who went to the tomb that morning, and it says that, "And the angel told them, 'Don't be afraid. You're seeking Jesus who was crucified. He's not here, but he is risen. Come and see the place where he lay.'" That was the message of the angel to those women. Come and see the empty spot. Come and see the blank slide. Come and see this place where there is not a body, because he's risen. And that testimony of our risen Lord, showing the victory of God over even death itself, is so powerful and matters so much to us. Tommy led us in the song, "Low in the grave he lay, but up from the grave he arose." I mean, especially in a time when in our body this week, we've lost two dear brothers. And when we can know something the world doesn't recognize, that the power of God is a power that transcends death itself and gives us hope for eternity in life, that matters. There's a message in empty places. There's a message in that. Last one, look at, and Tommy happened to have that verse on the screen already, over from John chapter 14, first couple of verses, that passage where Jesus, in the days before he was to be put to death, he wasn't asking folks to minister to him. He wasn't asking for comfort and help for himself. He started that passage with, "Don't let your hearts be troubled." He was encouraging those around him. He says, "You believe in God, believe also in me." And then he talks about an empty place. He says, "In my Father's house are many rooms." Some translations say mansions. If it weren't so, I would have told you, but I'm going to prepare a place for you. And if I go, I'm going to come and get you. I'm going to come again and receive you to myself, that where I'm going, you'll be also. He said, "I'm going to come so you can come home with me to this place." You know, Linda and John and I traveled to Yosemite about 2 weeks ago, just after Christmas, and got to a place I'd never been before, a little town that was a community that was inside the park. We had tried to reserve a place there for us, but the office was closed. We kind of knew the office would be closed. They'd give us direction when you go to the office. There'll be an envelope there for you. We sure enough went outside the office. There was an envelope in a box with our name on it and a key inside and a map for where the cabin that was reserved for us was. And we went down that dark, dark road on a cold, cold night to a place we'd never been before, and there was a spot for us. A cabin with a fireplace, firewood already cut. It was warm. There was power there and water, all we needed, you know. That was nice. Heaven's going to be far greater. There's a spot for you, a spot for each of us, an empty place that bears testimony to God's love for us. Just prepared for us. And that's amazing. It's amazing to me to think about. As you walk through those empty kind of places, you see that first one, that the empty garden, that a place God prepared for man, but bears witness to man's choice, our sinful nature, our listening to temptation and falling away. See those empty jars that are an evidence to God's providence and His care and His love for all of us, even the most helpless. See the empty tomb, the evidence of the power of God over death itself and of His love for us in sending His Son to be crucified and died on our behalf. The empty room, the evidence that He longs to be with us. He loves us and He wants us to go home, and He's made a spot. He's got a room. He's got a place ready for us. It's kind of interesting that the first one of those and the last one of those are both about places God prepared for man. And that the first one of those and the last one of those both have to do with us having a choice in the matter. And the first one, man thought he could do better. Listen to the temptation of Satan. Thought, I want more than this. Made the wrong choice. In the last one, an empty room, that place in heaven for us, there's a choice that remains for us about what voice we're going to listen to, about our heeding God's call, about our recognizing that what Adam and Eve did didn't work out that well. There's a better choice to be made. There was a scientist from years ago, Blaise Pascal, that said something always impressed me. He said, within each one of us, there's a God-shaped void. Within the heart of each one of us, there's an empty place, a place that only God can fill. And you read in Ecclesiastes about Solomon trying to fill that void with all other things. He tried to fill that empty spot with pleasure or wealth or countless things. And we've seen it. We've experienced it. I just hope that as you leave here, when your heart is telling you that there's something missing, that you know that the one thing that is intended to fill that empty place is God, and that He longs for us to choose Him, to follow Him. This morning, if you desire to make that choice and become a follower of His, be immersed in the waters of baptism, if you need the prayers of the congregation, if you're subject to His invitation, won't you come as we stand and sing?
Tomorrow may bring, if shadow or sunshine or rain, the Lord I know ruleth o'er everything, and all of my worry is vain. Living by faith in Jesus above, trusting, confiding in His great love, from all harm safe in His sheltering arm, I'm living by faith, and feel no alarm. Though tempests may blow and the storm clouds arise, obscuring the brightness of life, I'm never alarmed at the overcast skies. The Master looks on at the strife. Living by faith in Jesus above, trusting, confiding in His great love, from all harm safe in His sheltering arm, I'm living by faith and feel no alarm. Please be seated.